Welcome to East Meets West, episode 249. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Shank.
And we have a little announcement to make for those who watch the live stream on Sundays. Roger and I are going to change the day we record it. In fact, we want to make it a little more flexible, back to the old days of East Meets West, when we just kind of scheduled it as we went, rather than having a fixed time. So we're going to get away from doing the Sunday evenings. I'm not even going to say we'll never do a Sunday evening stream. We might just pop up one day and say, hey, you know what? We're going to stream it today. But you will still be able to get the audio version of the podcast. So if you're listening to the audio version, nothing changes for you.
No. It will be the same show that you download. And then Comic-Con at subbrilliant.com/EMW.
And then what?
And then comment on.
Oh, I thought you said Comic-Con.
No, comment on.
Yes. Yes, we have comets positioned in orbit should anything go wrong.
Low-orbiting comets.
Low-orbiting ion comets. But anyway, I want to explain to some folks who probably still wonder what the crap the show is. It is my experimental podcast, and not just mine, it's Roger's too. It's our recreational podcast. So it's our chance to just not have to prepare, not to have a specified topic, and just shoot the stuff. So I kind of feel like, you know, getting away from a specified time is in the spirit of that situation.
Yes, totally. I mean, this podcast has always been something that we've used to blow off steam and originally an excuse to come over to Tom's place and eat dinner. But when you moved away, we kind of started making it a little more. Actually, when did we start moving to once a week?
I was still in Oakland. You were coming over to my place in Oakland, but
scared at first, but you convinced me otherwise.
No, you actually probably came over more consistently to Oakland than you did San Francisco, I feel like.
Well, yeah, but you moved like less than a year after we started, didn't you?
We started 2005. I moved in 2006, I think. So yeah, about a year. That sounds about right. So we never know what we're going to talk about. We never discuss ahead of time what we're going to talk about. Although every once in a while we have a really good conversation going on in the pre-show before we actually start recording, and we forget to go back to that conversation, but that's not happening today. Portal 2, the video game, has taken up a large chunk of both of our lives.
Yes, I was cruising pretty well. I was doing like two-hour gaming sessions and then, you know, forcing myself to go to bed. I am now currently stuck on Chapter 8 with the three sentry guns. I've removed the sentry guns, but I'm just trying to figure out how to bridge the gap. I think I have it, but I don't know if I really have it.
I was trying to remember that section to figure out, and not to tell you necessarily, but just to remember how I solved it. And I flew through Portal 2. I got it done. Well, Steam says I took 14 hours. I think I took more like 12, considering I think sometimes I just had it on and running while I was off cooking dinner and stuff, so it clocked a few more hours, which is actually fairly long from some people who've really raced through it. But I liked it so much that I actually I'm going to start playing co-op mode. But I started replaying Portal today just as a comparison to kind of go back and refresh my memory. Portal's harder, I feel like. It's because it's not entirely about the puzzle. Whereas Portal 2 have harder puzzles, Portal was a lot more about hand-eye coordination. There were a couple puzzles that were stumping me today in Portal because I just couldn't get myself to fall through the portal in the right direction. You know, there's a couple of those where you in the original game, you have to fall from a height and then shoot a portal as you're falling to, you know, get yourself enough momentum to leap across.
I definitely had an easier time with the original Portal. It was fun, but it wasn't as, it was definitely more easy, or not, I shouldn't say easier, but it was basic. The puzzles were a lot quicker for me to figure out, and I didn't really have the issue with the hand-eye coordination, but it's probably because I also play a lot of first-person shooters, so I'm very used to, you know, reacting quickly with the mouse and shooting.
Yeah, I'm really bad at that. That's why I don't like first-person shooters as much, because I'm really slow So that's the kind of stuff that holds me up. Whereas Portal 2 felt like there were a couple things here and there that were requiring a little bit of hand-eye coordination, but it was mostly about puzzles. It was mostly about logic and figuring your way out of situations. And even when you weren't in a testing room per se, like the classic testing room from Portal, it was still puzzles. I don't want to say too much and spoil things for people who are still playing the game and haven't got there yet, but there's situations that are more freeform, but it's still a puzzle to figure out how to get past those situations.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because, I mean, this isn't really a spoiler, but there are certain areas in Portal 2 as you go up where you're kind of purposely misled because, you know, initially you just count the number of tiles that you can create portals with, and that kind of leads you to what the solution is. As you go further on in the game, they put, you know, essentially red herring or false, you know, locations that you think, oh, that has something to do with solving the puzzle. It has nothing, has absolutely nothing to do with solving the puzzle.
They put more vestigial puzzle pieces in. That was pretty interesting.
I wasted a good chunk of time, like, this obviously has to have some. You know, this obviously has something to do with solving the puzzle, and I spent like a good hour on it. And then, you know, I you know, as I swung around, I was like, wait a minute, there's one all the way up there. That's probably it. And you know, you portal up to that ledge, and you figure the rest of it. But there are definitely areas where you're gonna need to be a very thorough looking at the room that you're in, because a lot of those things, the solutions aren't openly clear, and in fact, in many cases, they're kept in a location that makes it very hard to see if you don't bounce around or look in the right direction.
I got to the point where I was starting by looking at the endpoint and working back from there, which is probably the way you should do all of these puzzles. But you don't always, because sometimes it's obvious, like you say, you're like, oh well, that wall is the only wall that I can put a portal on. Obviously, that's where I'm going to start. But with so much stuff that kind of leads you astray, I was finding the endpoint in any room and then working backwards from there more. I think maybe that's why I zoomed through it a little faster than I did the original Portal.
And really the only time I've been stuck is actually on this level that I am now. At most, it's taken me, I would say, like maybe a couple hours to figure out something. And some of them, it's basically my own fault because I'm looking so intently in one area that I neglect the very obvious in front of me.
Yeah, there's one section in particular I can think of where it was the only time I went and looked at a cheat. We looked at a walkthrough because I was getting so frustrated. And what I had done was so obvious. I don't want to say too much. I'm trying to see if there's a way to explain this without spoilering, but essentially I had put something down in one place and forgotten it.
Yeah.
And forgotten that I didn't have to stay there.
Yes.
And it was like, oh, all you do is move that and then everything works. Oh, right. Duh. You know, it was a mental block.
And once you get going with these puzzles and you're whipping through them, you feel kind of proud. I mean, you're definitely a little more euphoric because you're in a groove. You got momentum going, literally and figuratively, and it's cool. But there are times, like especially this level, that are just like, oh my god, I'm the dumbest person in the world. How come I can't figure it out?
Yeah, people are asking me which chapter. I think it was chapter 8.
Chapter 8 with the.
Near the end,
yes,
it was a big wide open area. I think it was, well, now it might not have been 82. It might have been 71, but anyway, it was a big wide open area with lots of pieces separated, and the exit totally isolated, without any easy way to get to it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I think I spend way too much time playing the game, but there are other times where I think, you know, this is not a bad use of time. I mean, I can think of a few games in my recent history that I felt that I just wasted my life playing, but Portal is not one of them. I'm actually happy to be playing Portal. I actually play fewer games now than I did, say, maybe even 2 or 3 years ago. I think it's just I think it just comes down to a lot of games that look and feel and play very similar to games I've played before. And, you know, you can only do so many World War II shooters. You can only do so many. You got future abilities with magic suit game, you know, and run around, and you can only do so many platform. This is the thing that annoys me the most about video games, at least, you know, the commercial video games, is that so much money is invested. It's almost like Hollywood, like we were talking about. I mean, there's so much money invested in these things that everyone's going to play it safe. They're going to go with a formula that's going to work. They're going to go with a plot or a game mechanic that's very familiar to people because they know it's going to sell. It's really hard to do a game that's unique, innovative, and that will sell well. I mean, Tim Schafer was great at it, but, you know, Psychonauts, one of my favorite games of all time, that didn't sell well at all, at least in existing commercial chains. I think he's doing better now that it's a downloadable game, both on Steam, and I think you can get off Xbox Live. And if anyone doesn't have it, I definitely recommend it. It's a great game. But it's, you know, it's like, I don't know. I see every time I see an ad or every time I see a review for a great AAA or AAA shooter or platformer or whatever game, it's just like it's invariably a game with the number 2 or 3 or 4 after it. And it has a similar plotline. Okay, let me think. What's the game? What's the game chat room that where you go around and you shoot people and you do? Oh, Bulletstorm. Is that it? Bulletstorm?
Every first person shooter ever.
It's literally the most boring game I've ever played. Everyone's like really into it. It's like, oh, you can grab people and throw them up in the air and freeze them and shoot them. It's like, really? I played like 30 minutes of it and I was bored to tears. It's like, this is literally the most mind-numbing thing I've ever played. And it was just like, seriously, you've spent all this money and this is what you came up with.
I've not played Bulletstorm. I have nothing to
you
say
can play. No. Well, give me so what have you played that you would say that you've spent a good deal of World of Warcraft? You play World of Warcraft all the time, don't you?
Yes.
Do you find it a good use of your time/money? Like after you've played say like 4 or 5 hours, do you feel like that was time well spent? Or do you feel like, oh my God, I just spent 4 or 5 hours?
I see what you're saying. Yeah, because with Portal 2, I feel like I'm sharpening my mind. It's as good as doing a crossword or some kind of, you know, logic puzzle or something. It does feel like I'm doing something a little more productive, right? Because it's not just mindless. I see what you're saying, like Bulletstorm. Whereas World of Warcraft has multiple elements. And the reason I don't feel like I've wasted time when I'm playing World of Warcraft is because some of it is puzzle. Some of it is building a character that you've had for years and years, so you get this feeling of progress and development. And a lot of it is social. You know, if you're in a good guild or you have some buddies that you play with, it's no different than, you know, hanging out, drinking beer, watching a game, having pizza, whatever. That's just as wasteful as playing a video game, but you're reconnecting with folks. And what's funny is that I actually am probably one of the worst people at that part of Warcraft because I'm so antisocial. I always want to solo. I always want to play alone just because I'm really concentrated on the story. And I think that's the third element is being able to read a really cool story being told. And I think that's true of multiple games, not just Warcraft, where you're unfolding this intricate story. World of Warcraft is this incredible lore that spans ages and is incredibly intricate. It's probably surpasses Star Trek and Star Wars in its breadth and depth of characters and history. But
you should write fan fiction for it, Tom.
There's plenty of people doing that. And there's tons of fiction written by Blizzard authors. There's whole panels at places like Dragon Con where the authors of the Warcraft books come on and discuss the lore of the universe and take questions about what's going to happen and what's happened in history and everything. And really, I think that's what makes good games successful is that kind of storyline. And I think that's what you're talking about with Bulletstorm is it doesn't sound like it has any kind of story.
It's the story's kind of written on the back of a matchbook. And what's interesting, you mentioned the social aspect because there are games like Left 4 Dead 1, Left 4 Dead 2, which I mean, the plot's very simple. You know, you're in a zombie land and you're trying to get the heck out of wherever, you know, you're at. But what makes it so entertaining is the group of people you play with.
Right.
Occasionally, actually more than occasionally, half the time you end up with jerks. A bunch of, you know, if not juvenile and you know, disposition and behavior. But other times when you come together with a really great group of people, it's fun. It's because, you know, it's like when you go out and you do an activity with, you know, other people. Yeah, you've always played baseball or softball since you were a kid, but, you know, depending on the people you play with, it can be a very enjoyable experience or a very tedious one. And, you know, it's those kinds of connections, I think, that makes, you know, especially, you know, online games make or break. I mean, if you don't have a world that's immersive enough to engage you, and you don't have, you know, the world populated with not just NPCs, but other players who are also as dedicated and engaged to it, it's kind of boring. I mean, I don't play Xbox Live games online with people anymore other than like three people I know, because most of the people you play with are jerks. And it's very dispiriting, because you come home from work, whatever, you get, you know, after I eat dinner, I just want to blow like an hour and a half, just blown off steam, get some stress off, and you get some loudmouth, you know, person who's, you know, using racial epithets or swearing, or it just makes you more aggravated. You just want to go out and reach and beat the crap out of that person, literally, like if you could reach through the camera or the TV and grab.
That's why I haven't played co-op on Portal 2 yet. I really just don't like playing online games with people I don't know, and even sometimes with people I do know, not because I don't like them, but I just, you know, sometimes you want to avoid human interaction.
You know, it's I play with Veronica, and, you know, I play with a bunch of other people, and it's great, you know. It's really just getting those people together, and in a case you'll find people online that are really cool and really awesome to play with. Unfortunately, they're in the minority.
Yeah. One thing that I did yesterday, sort of virtually with a bunch of people, was watch the new Doctor Who. Did you get a chance to see it?
Yes, I finally got to watch it. And it was great. I loved it. I thought they set everything up only to disappoint, because I have to wait till next week for the second parter.
All right, so to adequately talk about this episode, we do have to spoil it. So it's kind of why I wanted to push it towards the end of the show, because you should just stop listening now if you don't want to be spoiled. There's no way to discuss the salient points of this without talking about what happened in the episode. So I hope that's enough fair warning for you. I am very skeptical about whether I'm going to like this idea of, and here comes the big red spoiler, this is your last chance to stop listening, of the Doctor dying at the beginning of the episode.
You know, that didn't bother me as much, mainly because I thought it was crucial to the kind of plot of the story, and, you know, and motivated. You don't know how it's going to end. Maybe it might be something that's completely avoided. You don't know. And it could be a Doctor from the super far future, 200 plus years in the future from where they are. So it could be any number of things, in much the same way that River Song is, you know, someone you think you know, but the more you learn about her, the less you know about her. It's kind of the same way with the Doctor. The more you know about certain situations or his history, you know, you think you know him up to this point, it's like, oh, wait a minute, what? I don't know. I really liked this episode. Some of it was kind of hokey. The whole Nixon thing was kind of like, eh. But overall, I'm very excited to see what the second part of this episode sucks. Like it totally falls on its face. Then I'll probably be very skeptical for the rest of the season.
Well, and that's why I'm skeptical now, because here's the thing: the Doctor can't die because we have a whole season left.
Yes.
And because Matt Smith is not the last person who's ever going to play Doctor Who.
No.
So this is a dangerous trope, because it's supposed to shock me and make me wonder how we're going to get out of this one. But the only ways I can imagine it happening is to go, oh, he's not really dead. Oh, that wasn't actually Doctor Who. Oh, you know, all of this, it was all a dream. Like, I just
they've
don't
done that
see
before.
A satisfying way to get out of this, without really letting me down. And so I'm holding off being upset about it because I don't know how it's going to play out. But I think it's kind of manipulative.
I thought it was rather easy of them to use that ploy in the beginning, but. You know, I reserve my judgment until the second episode because really I can only place that in context in the entirety of both. And so I think it would be wrong for me to say like, it's kind of stupid. Although I will say again, the Nixon thing was kind of lame. I didn't, it's like other than, you know, throwing a couple of, stereotypical tropes about Americans, like stop, you know, they won't shoot. It's like, well, they're Americans. Of course they'll shoot.
They got a few digs in. I know.
It's you know, people do that all the time and it doesn't bother me, but what will bother me is if, and I saw this with the Christmas episode, they tend to latch on to overly, I shouldn't say simplistic, but incredibly easy, plot developments that kind of aren't as satisfying as, like, say, in the beginning when they started with Matt Smith, or even the later Tenet episodes where things got very, you know, got very convoluted, not convoluted, but a lot more complicated with the character and his relationships with other people. And I like that because, you know, there's points where, you know, during the Tenet years where he came up to a problem he didn't know the answer to. And I thought that was refreshing because up until this point, the doctor had like, oh, I have an answer for this. I have an answer for that. And it always felt like he was almost a demigod. He could figure anything out. It's kind of neat to see, you know, a character like that kind of, you know, be put under, be put in a position where they don't know the answer and what they might be doing might be wrong. So I don't know. It's 50-50 up to this point. I like it, though. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Her art she loves in the chat room says, River Song is his daughter. Ew.
You know what? David Tennant is going out with the doctor's daughter. Aren't they getting married?
With Peter Davison's daughter. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
The Nixon part I agree with, but it didn't bother me any more than the Churchill stuff. Or it's historical figures.
That kind of, see, stuff like that bothered me.
See,
it's
part of the cartoonish nature. It's part of the budget. And honestly, it's a trade-off for me. Should we pretend like historical figures never existed and never interact with them? Or should we have sort of rather disappointing characterizations as a trade-off for being able to have them? The Nixon thing was fine. They weren't great. They weren't great. I agree. They weren't lovely, but they also didn't ruin the episode for me.
It did ruin it. I
Nixon
was
ruined the episode for you. I thought you just said you loved the episode.
No, I say it didn't ruin the episode. What I really liked was they used the locations to great effect. I mean, this is the first Doctor Who that was shot in the U.S. or episode. And, you know, I thought they were just going to do a bunch of, you know, establishing shots and then shoot everything else inside like a studio set. But, you know, I think they made pretty good use so far of the, you know, the shooting they did do in Utah, especially when they were by the water. And I don't know if the moon itself was CG'd in there, but it was nice. I thought it was kind of classy in a way. Although there's like, you know, things like the spacesuits, obviously, you know, very fake and you know, something you put together or buy from somewhere. But, you know, again, like you said, it's a trade-off. It's not like they have Star
Trek. I liked the allusions that this episode had to previous episodes. The alien threat is very Stephen Moffat. It's reminiscent of the Weeping Angels in that it's a totally new way of terrifying you. It's an alien that sucks your soul out, but as soon as you turn away, you can't remember it's there. That's freaking brilliant. I love that trope. Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I said in many ways, it totally reminded me of Blink with the Weeping Angels. Like, it's the whole sight thing. Out of sight, out of mind. And with the angels, you know, you got to keep looking or if you look at a small animal, you just turn away for a second, it's boot darts away, you think it disappears when you turn your head back. I thought it was great. I liked it. Anyways, continue.
I liked that, and I liked I thought the other illusion, a couple of illusions, were the kid in the spacesuit. It's alluding to the Vashta Narada spacesuit with the you know, kind of a possession situation going on, and also to the episodes from the Chris Eccleston season with the little kid whose face becomes a face mask, and, you know, are you my mommy, with that, that kind of chilling, childish voice that always, like, I don't know, for me, it always sends chills down my spine.
Well, I was expecting, like, a skeleton, to be honest. I think we'd actually expect a little child. You know, I just expected the voice to be coming from it, but, you know, I thought it'd be something creepy, like,
I believe
a werewolf.
I believe that we will see something pretty nasty inside that spacesuit eventually.
Yes. And the aliens were well done. I was really impressed. Whoever did the makeup work and the special effects on them, I have to give them a special kudo award, because I was like, wow, that's like big budget stuff. It's not that, you know, oh, let me wrap this, you know, rubber thing around your head and then you kind of look like an alien.
Yeah.
No, this is like, no, this is really well done. They spent money, is what I'm saying.
Let's finish up the show with your impressions from Game of Thrones from last week. We had the whole preview East Meets West episode with Veronica. Then we went over to her place. We watched the movie, the show. You've never read the books.
No, what never read the books. I liked it. I definitely engaged. I thought there was a lot more sex out in the open, or I should say out in the open, just getting it on in screen. And strangely, only in one position, although I'm sure that'll change as the story goes on. Overall, I liked it. I am not as well versed in the universe or the countries or the nations as they're put together. So it'll be interesting to see how everything unfolds, because, you know, it is, you know, this is what we were talking about last time. It's not a high fantasy series. It's low fantasy. Yeah, you have elements of the fantastic in it, but really it's just a political, it's kind of political intrigue and kind of the jockeying for power by, you know, various people within this, you know, realm or kingdom.
You're right. It's low fantasy. And I was talking to you afterwards, and it seemed like you really had to pay attention to follow it if you haven't read the books, because a lot of the questions you were asking me, I pointed out, like, oh, well, they say this at this one point, but it's very brief. And if you're not really paying close attention, and I don't mean just listening and hearing every word, but remembering and going, okay, every single thing they say must be important, you're likely to miss some stuff, like the fact that Jaime and Cersei are brother and sister, for instance.
Yeah, so like stuff like that I didn't get, and I'm sure they'll bring it back up throughout the series, or at least in a way that you understand, but it didn't hit me right away like they were brother and sister. And I was very unclear of the role between the Lord of whatever the kingdom next to the giant frozen wall and the big fat guy. See, I thought they were brothers. I didn't realize they were just friends. So it was kind of confusing to see, you know, to make out the connections. But I'm hoping that as the series progresses, you know, more of that becomes clear, because,
well,
you know,
it's all clear. Here's the thing, and this is a good question. Everything that you need to know to understand that episode is mentioned. And it's mentioned specifically, but it's not spoon-fed to you. So you have to be paying attention at one point to an offhand comment and remember it 20 minutes later when you see a separate situation. And for instance, when Robert Baratheon, the king, comes in, he jokes with him about, you know, how we won the throne together and all this time. And you know that Eddard's name is Eddard Stark, House Winterfell, and he is the Lord of Winterfell, and he mentions that, you know, the king rules all the lands, and he holds, it's all in there, but it's not spoon fed. No one says, here comes the king, and he's not Robert's, and he's not Eddard Stark's brother. Well, you know, it's not clear.
Well, I know.
And if it were that clear, it'd be awful. I know we both agree on that. So do you think it goes too far in saying, you know what, we're going to provide all the information, but we're going to make you work for it because we're going to be sophisticated?
Well, I mean, at some point, I mean, they're going to have to at least, you know, revisit or at least re-explain in some fashion. And I understand you can't spoon feed it, but if you came into this without understanding any part of the universe, it's not that it's indecipherable. You understand by context, by watching the actions and the plot lines and the way characters interact with each other. But it would be something that if you watched it, you would watch a second or a third time,
yeah,
just to kind of suck the marrow, as it were, out of the episode.
You have to study it because, like I said, every question you've asked me, I've been able to answer by pointing to a part of the episode. Like, oh, yeah, they mentioned that there. I think with maybe a couple of minor exceptions. Yeah. But they're also the kinds of things that you would easily just not put a lot of importance on the first time you hear it and then forget that you heard it later on.
Exactly.
Well, that is it for this episode of East Meets West. Roger, any parting words?
Which is the best airport to fly into if you're flying into Houston? The small one, the hobby airport, or the larger one?
Well,
George,
it depends on what part of Houston you're going to, I guess. But I used to fly through hobby every once in a while. It's fine. They're both pretty good.
Which is easier to get out of, like if you're getting in a rental car?
Oh, I have no idea. I never got out. I always just transferred.
Mm. All right.
I'm waiting to see if the chat room has an opinion. They don't seem to.
They say NASA, Bush. Depends on luggage. Depends on luggage.
IHS, hobby's good. I don't think it makes much difference. I don't think it's like some cities where there's an airport that particularly... Did you hear about Lambert Field in St. Louis getting shut down because of a tornado that went through the airport?
Yes. I don't want to go through a tornado.
There's this airport on the east side in Illinois, from right across the river from St. Louis, called Mid-America, that they built a long time ago, and it's just a boondoggle. Like, there's no airlines running it. I think maybe a couple cargo planes. There have been some consumer airlines running out of there every once in a while, but I wonder if they're going to open that up temporarily and use that to get flights in and out.
I don't know. I just need to fly. I'll figure an airline, and then I guess I'll take it from there. Which airline I want to fly.
Well, that's it for this episode of East Meets West. You can find us on the web at sabrilliant.com/EMW. Huge thanks to Jammer B. Who's
Lambert St. Louis International Airport is closed indefinitely.
Oh, there you go. It's closed. Wow. Closed indefinitely. Thank you, Jammer B.
Wow.
That was Jammer B's voice right there.
That's pretty good. He should get a professional narration gig or something.
Big thanks to Jammer B for running the board back at the Twit Ranch while we've live streamed these. You can get all the episodes and subscribe to the feed at sabrilliant.com/EMW, as well as leaving your comments there. We will see you next time.
Bye. Thanks for watching and listening.
Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.